Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, a message of hope to revitalize the church in Eastern Europe. Pope Benedict's visit to the Czech Republic. Our correspondent shares her impressions. The Vatican Office for the Care of Migrants begins a pan-European meeting on the pastoral care of people of the street. And we look at how one ecumenical partner is working for justice for those who could end up on the street. Benedict is back at the papal residence in Castel Gandolfo after a three-day weekend pastoral journey to the Czech Republic. It was the Pope's first to the former Soviet bloc nation and coincided with the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Our Linda Bordoni was there with the Holy Father. She gave us her impressions of the visit.
Everyone around me here in Prague is describing the Pope's journey as a success. I've been thinking about it. And I think that in a way that may be very close to Pope Benedict's own nature, it's true. Yes, it hasn't been a showy theatrical success, with wildly cheering crowds and great big titles splashed all over the newspapers. Rather, it's been a quiet and composed success, much more similar to the man, Joseph Ratzinger himself. A success that will hopefully leave a long-lasting impression on the Czech people, as his deep words and his gentle ways seem to have penetrated some rather tough layers of diffidence and disinformation. Yes, diffidence, because almost proudly this fiercely secular society that professes to count only 5% of practicing Catholics initially seemed not only uninterested in his arrival, but even preoccupied it could cause chaotic traffic conditions in the city. And disinformation, because 40 years of communist regime successfully managed to stamp out the possibility of any kind of religious information at all. And still today, 20 years after the Velvet Revolution, Czechs know practically nothing about the Church and its doctrine, not to mention the fact that they are still profoundly suspicious of anything institutional. But 3 days of the Pope's permanence on Czech soil seem to have made a breach into the hearts and minds of this naturally reserved people. A people, I discovered, that is never overly demonstrative in showing its personal feelings. I think the change started on Saturday morning, when the Pope, with simplicity and warmth, greeted families and children in the Prague Church of Our Lady of Victory. He then moved with tranquility from event to event, stopping to engage with politicians, ecumenical representatives and intellectuals, as well as celebrating Vespers in Prague's Cathedral and the Eucharist at well-attended open-air masses. Overall, I would say, Pope Benedict has won over the hearts of the Czech people, also because he never neglected to show respect for the ideas and the fundamental principles of Czech civilization, as he touched on a number of themes. Themes like faith and reason, like truth, which he said is what sets us free, like the concept of Europe, not as a continent, but as a home, like the value that young people bring to society, as they are the hope of the church and of society. And the theme of hope was really the overriding message of this Czech pilgrimage, a message Pope Benedict successfully conveyed, never imposing his faith, but convincing the people to listen and to think with the serenity of reason, basically with just being himself. In Prague for Vatican Radio, I'm Linda Bordoni.
It's the Vatican Office for the Pastoral Care of Migrants, but it's also responsible for truck drivers and commuters, the homeless and those forced into prostitution.
Lorry drivers, railway workers, and the development of better road ethics leading to improved road safety, the liberation of women of the street, the care of street children, and finally those who are homeless.
Archbishop Agostino Marchetto is Secretary of the Pontifical Council for the Pastoral Care of Migrants and Itinerant People. He says that, though apparently these people don't have much in common, they do share one thing, the road or the street. And some of them end up there because they are among society's weakest and most vulnerable. But the Church is reaching out to them in ever-expanding ways.
We must remember each person is precious in the eyes of God and valuable to Him. Clearly, the needs of those who find themselves on the road street are far-reaching. Some of them are material and human, psychological and also spiritual. Some are crying out for help. Others are simply searching for a meaning and a synthesis to their lives. In this respect, I am thinking of the difference between those who work in long-distance lorry driving compared with the plight of the woman trafficked for prostitution.
Most of us depend on the road to get to work. For others, it represents their very livelihood. But for many, it can also be the means to an unexpected end. In the year 2008, 43,000 people died in traffic accidents and 1.7 million others were injured in Europe alone.
Not only in each incident tragic in the loss of life, but it deprives families of fathers, mothers, children, not to speak of economic and social damages. We should not forget that today 44% of goods in Europe are transported by road, bringing its own large constituency of lorry drivers with their own specific needs. Today, the problem of prostitution in the continent is suddenly escalating as the demand grows, with annually thousands of women, many who are trafficked, caught in a downward spiral from which they are unable to release themselves.
Even more vulnerable to trafficking are the some 250,000 children believed to be on Europe's streets, together with nearly 3 million homeless. Through its own institutions and pastoral initiatives and its partnerships with other agencies, the Church works to defend the rights of long-haul drivers, to promote responsible driving ethics, and to remove and care for those who've made the streets their home.
We need continually to be aware of our need to collaborate and work together when and where possible. Above all, our unique contribution must be, in the words of Pope Benedict in his recent encyclical Caritas in Veritate, to have a mission of truth to accomplish in every time and circumstances for a society that is attuned to man, to his dignity, to his vocation.
Archbishop Agostino Marchetto is Secretary for the Pontifical Council for Migrants and Itinerants. Living on the street, a series of unimaginable misfortunes, and it could happen to just about any of us. For Tara, an 8-year-old girl in Cambodia, the unimaginable happened. After her brother fell ill, Tara's father asked a local rice mill owner for a $25 loan for medication. Little did he know at the time, his wife and children were expected to pay it off for the rest of their lives.
In Asia, we find that victims of forced slave labor, in fact, are families, are generations oftentimes of families.
Amy Roth left her enviable job at the U.S. Embassy to the Holy See to work for a nonprofit organization which aims to bring justice to people like Tara and her family.
Looking at families, IJM has brought out of forced slave labor in brick kilns or rice mills, families that in fact would have had a member fall sick. They would have taken a loan for $25. And for years, Tracy, years, not just the family member that took the loan, but maybe the family member's spouse and children will work 8, 10, 12 hours a day, not leaving the premises for a loan of $25, because, of course, it is more advantageous for the brick kiln owner or the rice mill owner to, in fact, have slave labor than for them to ever pay off the $25 loan.
Amy now works for the Washington-based International Justice Mission, a human rights agency that secures justice for victims of slavery, sexual exploitation, and other forms of violent oppression. IGM lawyers, investigators, and aftercare professionals work with local officials in 13 countries in the developing world to rescue victims and ensure aftercare, to prosecute perpetrators, and to promote functioning public justice systems in areas where they're the weakest.
We had an operation that we conducted with local law enforcement in every one of the 13 countries in which we work. Our authority is, in fact, only granted through our collaboration with local law enforcement. But we were able to work with local law enforcement and go into a rice mill and pull out 37 individuals who had been in forced slave labor, indentured servitude, modern-day slavery. There's no other word for it. And the youngest of those victims was a one-day-old child.
Oh, goodness.
One-day-old child. And it was the baby's 8-year-old sister who was brave enough, when many of the adults would not be brave enough, to come forth and actually give testimony that got freedom for all 37. So I have seen and met some of the most courageous people in some of the most destitute of situations. And in fact, all that was needed for them to in fact embrace that courage was one person standing behind them to say, yes, you deserve justice in this instance. And from that came a voice. And from that, lives were changed.
At least 14,000 lives were changed over the first 13 years of IJM's existence through its rescue and justice missions in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. IJM's volunteers and staff say they've been called to this mission through their faith.
International Justice Mission was given that name because we have, in fact, have found in the scriptures a biblical mandate to seek justice, whether that be in Isaiah 1:17, which does say to seek justice, defend the widow, and plead for the orphan, or also in Micah or other places throughout the scriptures where, frankly, God is calling us to courage and calling us to defend those who, in fact, are weak or most vulnerable. So we are a faith-based organization. And as I say, working in 13 countries around the world, 16 different offices, defending victims of sexual exploitation, violent oppression, forced slave labor, unprosecuted rape, illegal land seizure. So many of these human rights issues, in fact, and we are in the world to be advocates for those who don't have advocates. The 13 countries in which we work are in the developing world, and they are countries which unfortunately do not have functioning public justice systems. So the intent of International Justice Mission is to be an advocate or a representative of justice, helping to build up the capacities and the potential of public justice systems to defend the poor so that the crimes that we work against, as I said, child sexual exploitation, forced slave labor, illegal land seizure, these things are illegal in every one of the countries in which we work. What we're trying to do is be present, be advocates to build up the public justice system so these crimes don't happen in the first place.
Okay, getting back to the faith-based initiative here, is it an ecumenical service that you're offering, or are people from across the board invited to be volunteers and to help on your team?
We are certainly ecumenical, and it's important to note that we as employees or representatives, staff, fellows, interns of International Justice Mission are in the world and feel that we have our mandate based and grounded in the scriptures. We do not proselytize, but our great hope is that our acts will speak for the biblical base from which we work.
Okay, I saw from your website that you work in Africa, Latin America, South and Southeast Asia.
That's right.
You said that many of these cases of abuse are pretty much the same across the board in all of these different countries. Are there any places where it's worse than others?
A great question. In principle, I'd say yes to that, because depending on the state or the force or health, let's say, of the public justice system in the country in which we work, we find that these crimes happen to a greater or lesser extent. I would say also, though, the issues that we address are often regionally based. For example, in Southeast Asia, we tend to find that the work that we've been called to do is that of defending children who have been sexually exploited. That is the work or the void that we've found that we need to fill. In Africa, we work in 4 countries in Africa. The issue at hand there tends to be illegal land seizure. In Latin America, the issue we found that is not being addressed by the public justice systems is unprosecuted rape. In other places in Asia, we find that the overwhelming issue is forced slave labor. So, in principle, these are certainly human rights abuses under the largest sense. They do have different manifestations depending upon the region we found. But an interesting point to note is none of these things, these crimes, if you will, against justice that I've just mentioned are really knotty human rights issues. They're not that complex. In fact, what it is, it's just unvarnished, raw violence against the vulnerable and the oppressed. So that is the common theme in all of the work that we do, though, as I said, it has often regional manifestations.
On a recent trip to Cambodia, Amy met Bella, who, as a young girl, was rescued from a brothel where she was forced into prostitution. She was freed in a daring operation conducted by IGM investigators along with local police.
In Phnom Penh, there is a certain part of town and a certain building, in fact, in town that is the center of the illegal sex, drugs, and arms trade. And IJM is an organization comprised of lawyers, undercover investigators, social workers, and then individuals like myself who are trying to give voice or engage a public dialogue about modern-day slavery. But if I tell you the story of Bella, it starts in the Anarchy Building, which is this dark, dangerous building, as I said, the heart of the illegal sex, drug, and arms trade. And in 2004, IJM and undercover investigators, acting on information they had gathered, went into the Anarchy Building. And what our investigators do is, in principle, pose as clients to go in and actually collect video evidence, audio evidence of perpetrators or pimps or women who are facilitating this, often called mama-san, and just to actually see what is going on, see if in fact there are forced minors in the situation. Anyway, they came across a young girl introduced as Bella. She was at that time 13 years old, and she was being offered for sex. What we did with that information is went to local law enforcement. The evidence was so strong that they agreed to conduct an operation. So they went in and, in fact, brought Bella to safety with 2 other young girls, also 13 years old. And perpetrators were held accountable with that very evidence which we collected. And those 3 young girls were put into aftercare, which is another critical part of what IJM does. Victim rescue, perpetrator accountability, and victim aftercare. Anyway, Bella has been in aftercare since that rescue in 2004. I just saw her when I was in Cambodia. She is now a beautiful young woman. She is, I think, to a great extent, healed from much of the injustice and the violence against her. And I actually sat down and spoke to her in English. And the point is, she now can articulate in a foreign language some of the most difficult things that I think anyone could ever go through. And I could see that a life was changed because someone advocated for her. Now, she's had to do all the hard work, but she has had loving people around her that have encouraged her every step of the way.
So IGM actually has some sort of psychological counseling, also medical care. I imagine that these children, these people who are victims of such violence, really have a hard time getting back to what it could be a normal life.
That's right. And it is our great hope and great belief that with long-term, loving, professional aftercare, that yes, a regular, normal life is within their grasp. But we have seen in the thousands of victims we have rescued after such violence and abuse, it's a long, long road, and it takes a great deal of concentrated care. IJM itself does not offer aftercare, but in all 13 of the countries in which we work, we partner with quality aftercare, some of it faith-based, some of it not, just because there oftentimes is not the opportunity of offering that. But yes, we partner with them. There is psychological counseling certainly provided. There is vocational training, education of all sorts offered. And then, as I say, if nothing else, sometimes the most important piece to recovery is just a loving, caring environment and individuals to walk them through, really working through the great violence that's done to them. This, I believe, sexual exploitation is one of the greatest violences one can perpetrate against another. So this tends to be the most difficult of our casework to actually address and actually, as you had said, bring a victim from such a dark place to a place of light, which we would call a normal life. It's a long path, but we've walk that path with over 1,000 individuals now. And nonetheless, with that difficult work acknowledged, we see great hope in it. We see that there really is a possibility for hope to be reinstilled in the lives of these victims.
Now, you mentioned that your people are working to provide justice in areas where the justice systems are the weakest. But how effective can you be in areas where corruption and just bureaucratic inefficiencies must be endemic?
Therein certainly lies our challenge. But after 13 years in the field, and frankly, IJM, given the holistic approach that we take, looking at victim rescue, victim aftercare, perpetrator accountability, and then what we call structural transformation, which is building up these justice systems. After really working with such a vast look at the problem, or an integral look at the problem, 13 years of that on the front lines, we have found that really the only way to go forward is to address the issues of corruption or broken public justice systems head on, and to work in collaboration as opposed to competition, and to work with whatever pieces of the system that are there that are functioning, and to in fact bring capacity to build up what is working, certainly point out what is not working, and then try to bring resources to the table to fix the things that are not working. Now, certainly there needs to be social demand built so that, in fact, citizens in countries are asking for that. There needs to be a sense of understanding and agreement within the governments with which we work. But the thing is, we're finding that doesn't come easy, but those things do come with time and persistence and professionalism and, frankly, an honest approach. So after 13 years, we believe the only way to move forward is with local law enforcement. And in every system, we have found there are individuals who, in fact, want to see the justice system itself work. They understand that there are injustices being committed against the poor and the vulnerable. And we work with those individuals. And after 13 years, we found success. Not easy. In some places, it's come easier than others, but nonetheless, we are not moving away from a challenge, and we're going to continue in that path.
By bringing to justice 1, 2, 3 perpetrators of these crimes, it's kind of a piecemeal way. I don't want to be derogatory in any way, but it is a one-step-at-a-time sort of approach to trying to heal the brokenness of the justice system. I mean, is it realistic that you can bring change to the whole system?
Another great question, and certainly one that we have sat with and looked at from all different angles through 13 years. And the short answer would be, yes, we believe this is the best approach, and it's what we can bring to the table that others are not. Granted, we're grateful that there are other organizations and other individuals taking different approaches. They are looking at poverty alleviation. They're looking at education. And I think together, writ large, we'll find ways to move or change the system. But one thing that International Justice Mission does and can do with this, as you say, step-by-step approach, is we're doing something that has, frankly, great impact, and that is changing the fear equation. Though we may only seek justice for 5 victims and 1 perpetrator, nonetheless, if a perpetrator is held accountable, it sends a message to other perpetrators, and it changes the fear equation, frankly. It, in fact, says to perpetrators, boy, you better be the one that's frightened because there will be justice to pay. There are consequences for the acts of injustice you're committing. And hopefully that will then allow victims to not be fearful. And it will send a message that over time will hopefully change the system and have a larger effect.
You've got so many investigators and team players in this all over the place. You ever hear anybody say, gee, you know, I've seen so much violence, I've seen so much hatred, I just can't take this anymore, I've got to go, I've got to quit?
I hear often and feel it myself. The first part of what you said is I've seen so much violence, I've seen so much injustice, I've seen so much brokenness, I've seen so much sadness. The other part of the equation, and I think this is the piece that keeps us moving forward and staying in this, is that we've also seen so much rehabilitation. We've also seen so much hope. It's extraordinary how much courage and encouragement one can get from sitting in front of someone like Bella, who has walked a much darker and difficult road than I. And if she can continue, I certainly can continue.
You left a great job here in Rome to go to Washington, D.C. to work for International Justice Mission. Any regrets?
I have some regrets, but I have no doubts. And the regrets would be certainly leaving such wonderful people with whom I was so fortunate to work at the U.S. Embassy to the Holy See, here as well at Vatican Radio, in this glorious city. I met so many people and had the great fortune to work with people who inspired me, encouraged me, and taught me. So leaving them and leaving this, as I said, glorious city certainly fills me with regret on many a day. But I don't have doubts that I am exactly where I'm supposed to be, doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing. With 27 million slaves in the world today, and my great fortune having been able to meet some of them, in fact, and see the result of the efforts of International Justice Mission and other people working in this field, I don't have any doubts.
Okay, Amy, thanks for being with me, and good luck to you and your new mission.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be with you again.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And a warm thanks there to Amy Roth, and best wishes again to her for her new job as Press and Media Relations Officer for the International Justice Mission. And that brings our program to a close today. Thank you for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.